Welcome to the last session. We were going to be four on this panel. I was going to moderate. Huda Mizioudet, you might have heard from Tunisia, was not able to join us because she could not get a visa. So there are the three of us, which is a really dramatic example of the change going on in the Middle East and the fact that because of the change of regime in Tunisia, and also because of the flood of refugees that is even impacting us here in this conference. Since Hassan and I introduced ourselves this morning, I'm just going to ask Svetlana to introduce herself. Then we will proceed to discuss three case studies: that of Spain, which has had a successful transition to democracy; then Moldova, which is in transit; and finally, Morocco, which we hope will soon be in transit. So, Svetlana.
Thank you very much. My name is Svetlana Sobeika. I'm a historian from Republic of Moldova. I'm also associate professor at Moldova State University. I got my PhD from Romania more than a decade ago. And I teach variety of courses in the history methodology, Southeastern European history. And I was a Fulbright Fellow. I'm a fresh Fulbright. It was last year at Stanford University in California. That's why I'm here. Thank you.
Well, let's begin with Spain. As we pointed out, or you see in the program, I was had my Fulbright to Madrid in 1974-75. That means I was there before the old man kicked off, before Franco died. And I had come to Spain with an open attitude about whether it was good for Spain to have had this strong regime after the Civil War. And of course, after study, I came to the conclusion that perhaps more harm was done than good. But anyway, the king had been groomed by Franco, and to take his place. The monarchy was officially restored in 1947, but Franco was the regent. And the king inherited Franco's powers. He inherited his prime minister, Arias Navarro. And one of the first things he did in the first months of his reign was to ask for his resignation, and then handpicked his successor, Adolfo Suarez, who carried out the transition. The restoration of the Communist Party was a basic element in achieving a plurality of parties, the main ones being the socialists, the communists, and then the right wing, the Popular Party. And Suarez made a coalition of Christian Democratic and centrist and liberal parties to form a democratic center. Then the constitution was approved around 78, I believe, and he was able to rule for 4 years, but with tremendous tensions. The program of establishing autonomous regions was begun, Catalonia and the Basque Country being the most historically communities that had historical roots and wanted their piece of self-government. And then there was a crisis in 82. A change of government. By that time, I had made my transition to be a journalist. I entered National Radio in 1979. And when attempted coup took place on February 23rd, 82, I was at work. I was in the radio. All of a sudden, someone came in saying there have been shots in the Parliament building. Now, at that time, it's the National Radio Television. The second floor, or the first floor, had a wing. It was a news service of television, and I knew it. They had a direct link with the Parliament. There were only two direct links with the Parliament: that television and the King's residence had direct links to follow what was going on in the Parliament. So I rushed downstairs to see Tejero firing in the ceiling, and all the deputies cowering under their benches, except for Suarez, who maintained his seat, and also Carrillo, the head of the Communist Party. But my first reaction was, and when a colleague said, this is your president's fault. But I was perplexed because any serious coup would have had the rebel forces occupying the center of communication immediately. And it took them some time before they got to the radio television, and they were basically in control for maybe 30 minutes before loyalist forces expelled them. And to me, that was a signal that the coup would be unsuccessful. The king was a key figure in maintaining loyalty to the constitutional order. He was in contact with all the military leaders because every province had a military governor, or every region, district, had a military governor as well as a civil governor. And he made sure that the key military leaders would maintain their loyalty to him as commander-in-chief of the forces. So that crisis was overcome thanks to the intervention of the king, the firm support to the king, in contrast to his brother-in-law, King Constantine in Greece, the Queen Sophia's brother, who had gone along with the coup. And so besides his sympathy for democratic process, the king also had an example of what could happen if he made a false step. So the crisis was overcome, and it really established Juan Carlos as a firm figure of stability for the Spanish democracy. The socialists came to power in 1982 under Felipe González. They stayed in power for nearly 25 or 20 until 1996, made tremendous changes in Spain. he joined NATO and also the European Union. And thanks to his special relationship with Helmut Kohl, also brought lots of structural funds to Spain, so that now there's a wonderful network of superhighways throughout the country, and of course the high-speed lines, many of the trains provided by Siemens, I believe. So the transition was secured and even finally anchored when the right wing came to power with José María Aznar in 1996. And he did not have an absolute majority, but he had to rule in with the support of the Catalan nationalists, who have always been a pivotal party, giving their support and getting more concessions to whichever party does not win an absolute majority. And finally, in the year 2000, Aznar got a complete majority. With some perhaps negative consequences, which might have been the alliance, a strong alliance in the intervention in Iraq. 2004, he was prepared. He had done a very good job of administration, and Spain had prospered under the Popular Party leadership. And it was entirely likely that his successor, his handpicked successor, would Mariano Rajoy would take over, because the polls gave the Popular Party an advantage. But then the train bombs of Atocha occurred. I live across the street from the station, but my building faces the other direction, so I didn't hear the blast. It was finally a friend who called me to tell me that what had happened, and I was busy working the whole day reporting on it on the basis of television reports, because that's the way radio works. So then there was the belief that Aznar immediately accused the ETA, the Basque terrorists, and it soon became clear that it was Al-Qaeda. And this figured very negatively in the swing voters. And so the elections were the following Saturday, following Sunday, and they shifted radically in favor of the socialists. So it was thanks to the reaction of the Popular Party to the train bombs that the socialists came back into power, and they've been in power for 8 years. So that, in a nutshell, is a success story of the Spanish transition, in which the role of the monarchy was very important and has basically established itself as a moderating influence for the continuance of democracy in Spain. So that's one case study. Now we'll hear the case study of Moldova.
Thank you. Republic of Moldova is a former Soviet socialist republic situated between Romania and Ukraine. We gained our independence in 1991, so we have 2 decades of a transition toward democracy. I will mostly speak about the last decade because it seems to me the more relevant for our discussion. Specifically, considering 2001-2008 period when Communist Party came into power, we have the case of the proof that any authoritarian regime has at least 2 phobias. One is fear, meticulously induced into the society, and another is pointing out an external enemy. And this happens in today Moldova, as this happened this decade. Communist Party was in power, and it played out this card of a danger with unification with Romania. I must make a parenthesis and say that Moldova's status shifted during the last century several times between Romania and Russia and Soviet Union afterwards. So any opposition leader who was referring to Romania was considered an enemy. So we have now an enemy Victor's message, and the society divided in patriots and traitors, and politicians referring constantly on historical arguments in their political messages. We have different indicators showing the aggravation of economical and political crisis. We have centralization of administration, poor quality of governance, significant deterioration of business environment, and of course worsened and widespread corruption. It was actually during the 8 years of communists being into power, it was the assimilation of dialogue. They came into power showing this or taking this message of the union, of the possible union or with the join of Moldova with the European Union, but it was a dialogue without any change. It was a mimicry of reforms, and it was a vulnerable democracy, as some experts are saying. And we also have a Russian army placed on a left bank of Dniester River. So we have a small part of Moldova which is not under a Moldovan government control. We have a Transnistrian conflict called frozen conflict right now, which also sets us back. The events that took place in April 2009, after communists declared their victory in the following in the elections, is known in international media as the Twitter revolution. The impact is most important, the impact of those events, the post so-called revolution event. So since 2009, we failed to elect our president. September 2010, referendum on whether president should be elected by universal suffrage or by parliament failed due to low turnout. So European Union is far away, the newspaper headlines today show that European Union is disappointed in the promised reforms. I'm thinking about Soviet legacies a lot, and in a previous roundtable discussions we talked about how Education can be an example in showing how difficult the way toward democracy is. The most difficult obstacle seem to me is the mentality of the population, and we can feel this nostalgia for the past. As about Jürgen Kocher remark that what is the alternative to capitalism? You will hear often in Moldova saying, if capitalism is good and communism is bad, why do I live a poor life? I think many people in Moldova still did not notice the irreversibility of democratic processes. What comes to my mind is the recent visit of the American Vice President Joe Biden in the middle of March this year. It was a huge event for Moldovans, and I think besides those discussions about where Moldova stands between Russia and between European Union and in which sphere of influence it is, it was an important sign of support for those democratic processes we have embarked as well as a sign of hope for Moldovan citizens. Joe Biden called Moldova a successful story. Well, considering successful story, considering the situation in African countries, I think we should wait for a while to see whether it is a successful story or not. Into those difficult processes, and I, as I have emphasized earlier, it depends on, and it's in every field, it depends on each of us whether we are going forward or not. Thank you.
I'm going to begin with a few dates, if you allow me, just to put things in context. 2011, these days they're using a term, the media are using a term called the Arab Spring. It's not a spring, and it's not only Arab, and it's going to take much longer than a spring or a year to clear. But this is a term which I must prefer to the one that used to be applied to the whole region and for a long, long time, and that word was la malédiction arabe, or the Arab curse. Here's a group of people with a lot of resources, a lot of money, but all the ills of modern times. Dictatorship, human rights abuses, inequality, joblessness, etc., etc., etc. Underlying this malediction or this curse is the fact that most media blame the regimes. And they often, for commenting on any event in the world, a media like Al Jazeera, for example, would speak about the Arab governments and the Sharia al-Arabi, or the road Arab, the normal people. Now, a single spark, a single event, a young man, unemployed, educated, being kicked by a policewoman, it was a woman, for no reason that he wanted to sell his vegetables, and then he decides he's had too much, he burns himself, and that provokes a revolution in a country that was on the last of the potential. That was Tunisia, which was the last country to, because it had a strong regime, and the regime had opted from the beginning away from the army and put all the power in the police, and especially the secret police. But from January to, in the space of 3 or 4 weeks, it was over. And then, before it even completed itself, all the other frustrations of all the other Arab countries started emerging in different forms. The immediate one, because Egypt had just experienced elections that were falsified. And then we heard movement, we started seeing movement emerge everywhere. In my country then, the phenomenon of this frustration that had been accumulating for so many years, this frustration emerged in the form of a group that called itself, a Facebook group that called itself the February 20th, because this is the date, about 20,000 people, young people, called for mass demonstrations in the country, calling for change. Now, the slogan that you can hear if you understand Arabic all over is, the people want And then the rest you can substitute. In Tunisia, the people want the end of the regime. Al-Shab yurid isqat al-nidam. The people want the fall of the regime. The same thing. And then they started substituting things. In Morocco, the slogans, the demonstration on 20th February were widespread all over the country, reaching cities, very small towns that had never experienced anything like that before. But the context in which the Moroccan event happened was different because we have a young king, relatively young. He has been in power for only 10 years compared to Tunisia, 23 years, Egypt, 40 years, and all the others, except perhaps Syria. And the king, when he took power from his father Hassan II had been king for 38 years, and 38 years, like Franco and all the dictatorships, human rights abuses, etc. The king, from the moment he took power, decided to start pushing away the red lines. And he made a lot of decisions to go toward more human rights, more freedom of expression, more freedoms in general. But this is not enough, because this king had inherited huge economic problems that he could not... they're too much for anyone. He tried a number of approaches, and I personally call it the two-pole approach. He tried at the same time to fix the economic problem from the top by bringing foreign investment, including personal foreign investment from sovereign funds, from Kuwait and Bahrain and the Emirates, to do huge projects in tourism, textiles, solar energy, and a lot of other housing, and then also take it from the bottom, which is the social problem. And he started creating a foundation that is to listen to the poorest of the population, bringing money and investing. But all this was not enough, because each year you get 1 million people into the age in which they have to work. It's a young population, and the average age is like 18 or 17, and each year the huge demands. Now, when this movement started, the king decided perhaps this is the moment to do it softly and avoid the problems that we can see. So 2 weeks after this demonstration, he made a speech to the nation announcing the creation of a commission to revise deeply the current constitution and introduce a number of principles, which are separation of powers, human rights, what I said this morning, and gave this commission 4 months to prepare a draft and also consult. He asked the commission to consult with all the powers, the young, the old, the parties, the syndicates, and they've been meeting with these people all the time. Now, this is different. This is the first time in which the king doesn't bring a constitution to the people and tell them to vote yes, and it's 99.99%. There's a commission, and if you look at the composition of the commission, it reflects a center-left kind of political leaning. So a lot of people had been on the left, reaching the center, and also balanced between women and men. And now the committee is drafting the constitution, the new constitution, and it's supposed to be submitted to the king in June. In June, and the king will examine this and have the people vote on it. What is important is not this. What is important is the fact that as soon as this was mentioned, all kinds of groups opened on the internet a national debate on the constitution. There's a group called Reform or Reform.ma, which simply takes the current constitution and asks readers to vote. There's Article 19, which puts all the powers in the hands of the king, and you can see how many people vote for or against. You can see that 90% of the people do not want that, and only 5%. And all the articles, which is very interesting, because you can see, and the king can see, and anyone can see, where the population, that at least the population can read and vote on Facebook, what they believe. Now, the atmosphere at the moment in which I'm speaking is such that every citizen feels implicated and wants to something to be put in the constitution, which became almost funny. Exactly. We want this in the constitution. Women, of course, equality. We want the Berber phone, the ones who speak Amazigh or Berbers. Want the question of Berber phones, the regions. Everybody wants to do that. But the committee is going to bring some kind of historic, I believe, some kind of historic compromise in which the powers in the nation will be redistributed. I am not sure we are going to. We have, of course, the example of the UK, the example of Spain. Everyone seems to agree on a constitutional monarchy. On a constitutional monarchy in which the king reigns, rules a little bit, but not so much. But the prime minister has the power, for example, to nominate government officials and so on. And the parliament, the government is responsible for parliament and so on and so forth. How the text is going to bring all these things is still in question. Some people think that it's a trick. It's going to wait for the things to come down and then return to the old system or make only cosmetic changes. Others believe that the king is really serious about this moment and that he wants to, he thinks the country is ready for a democratic change, and he thinks that this is the time to do it. And going back to that speech he made on the 9th of March, the principles that he enunciated all go toward a system in which the king remains a symbol of the nation, he remains the final arbiter, but that the business of government is going to be put in the hands of a government. How all this is going to work out, we don't know. Just 10 days ago, there was an explosion in a souk in Marrakesh, the most popular place in Marrakesh that many Fulbright friends visited, in a cafe. And only the day when did I leave? 2 days ago. Coming here, it was announced that they arrested three people who are Al-Qaeda affiliates. So, but a lot of questions remain. Even if the investigation, the technical investigation, is done with American police, French police, Spanish police, and in all transparency. And this time, there's a difference. There was a terrorist attack 10 years ago, or 8 years, 9 years ago, and that was only a pretext to arrest all the Islamists that had any kind of connection. This time, they did not make any arrest until they reached, through the broken pieces of cell phones, etc., they reached the guys, the man who actually left the cases in that cafe and that killed 18 people, including, no, 16 people, including 8 French. No, there's still a lot of questions. There's still people who believe that there are a lot of vested interests that will resist change. But I think that if the king is genuine about reform, the people will approve, and it will be the year 2011 will be the year in which year one. It's not 2011, but it'll be year one in Moroccan history. Despite my personal assessment, since no draft of the constitution yet has been submitted to us, my own guess or my own assessment is that the principles of all democratic nations will be embedded in the constitution. The basic freedoms, the constitution of multi-party, we had multi-party before, but it was puppets parties. But never mind, we, unlike Tunisia or Egypt, we really had, but it was not real parties. Now, the system is going to embed democratic principles, the separation of powers, elections that are the periodicity of elections, all the hallmarks of democratic change, and the king will remain as the final arbiter. We'll have to wait until the text is submitted for a vote next month in June, before I can do. But I think with caution that we can be optimistic that the country is going to go through towards a period of democratic transition, and I'm to go toward a period of democratic transition beginning this year, which will lead to full democratization down the line. Thank you very much.
Now, we agreed that we would try to contrast the three case studies, the contrast, and to point out the similarities. And I've noticed, of course, the similarity of referendums. I didn't mention that. Well, I did mention that the Constitution was approved in 1978 in a referendum, which had a it had 60 to 70% participation, which was good for a country that was not used to participation. And this is a key a key condition. And I was struck by Svetlana pointing out to a low turnout for the referendum in 2010. And we will yet to see what the turnout will be for the referendum in Morocco. Why, Svetlana, do you think that the turnout was so low?
What is what happened after the elections? We have now three parties into power that formed an alliance, which is called Alliance for European Integration. So the European integration message is taken forward. And the referendum was shortly after the elections, if I'm not mistaken. And all the capacity of parties' capacity was implemented in those parliamentary elections, and because the alliance took the lead, so they thought that it might referendum is nearly will show nearly the same results. But 40% of voters voted for communist parties still, so it's a huge a huge percentage. So we have nearly more than two-thirds of parliament of representing this communist party, and the communists worked quite hard in order to give an anti-referendum message. So they said, if you vote for a referendum, for if you go to referendum, actually it was about going or not going, not even what if you go to referendum, then you support the alliance, and then you will never get into European Union, because we have a very close ties with Russia, with the former Soviet republics, and it's there. So how we can be lose those ties? Do you want to eat the situation to worsen? So many people were very much reluctant about those changes that might come. But also, if I may continue, I was thinking about similarities between those three cases, and what came to my mind is comparing the situation in Africa, specifically with what was happening in Eastern Europe end of 80s. Beginning of 90s, not much comparing it with the situation in so the colored revolutions in Georgia, Ukraine, Serbia, or in Moldova 2009, because the new era is starting. And it was the fight against dictatorship. And it seems to me it's much more, we do not want to diminish the situation in Africa and the challenges the society faces. It seems to me that the comparison is much more appropriate as from a historical point of view, considering what was happening in Eastern Europe. And also, it is not an end of a president, it's actually an end of an era. That what was happening end of 80s, beginning of 90s, but for us as well. The most important is what is next, how this post-revolutionary transitions goes on. And of course, we are on better ground because we have the legislation, we have the constitution, we have electoral codes, media laws, but the problem is how it works, how the legislation works. European Union experts are coming to our region and saying, wow, the legislation is nearly perfect, but we do not feel like legislation works. So, Central and Eastern Europe in the end of 90s, they did not have, let's say, many of these things, considering legislation, but they had civil society that united against against the government, against the rule. Solidarność, I'm referring to Solidarność in Poland or Charter 77. So these are also contrasting points we are going to. Thank you.
Yes, and Hassan, could you tell us about the experience of Morocco with referenda and how can you predict on the basis of the past how to what extent there will be a great participation in that in
the
referendum?
Well, there is an element of comparison. The past, for example, all the media will sing the same song. Whatever the king decides, it's launched, even if it's a new constitution occurring a year after the previous one. No problem. Everybody agrees and everybody applauds, and all the opposition people have no possibility to say no. And if they I never see any during the day of the referendum, only black pieces of paper, because the yes is in white and no is in black. And outside the offices where people vote, it's a rain of black flyers, little pieces of black. Nobody. But now, for the past several months, all kinds of, in the public media, in the on television, you get people from all kinds of including the extremists, if you like. They bring them and they analyze their. There's more freedom of speech and there is more freedom to express your view. There are people in Morocco who want a central government because they think that if the power, the central power, is kind of abandoned, there will be civil wars and problems between the north and the south and the ethnic problems and tribal problems and things like that. But I want to. So this time there is a difference. There will be a referendum, but when the referendum is announced, all the points of view will be allowed to express themselves on television, on public television. Now I'm also waiting for that. The second, including people who want to just advocate and campaign for stay at home, don't come. We don't have the same rule about a minimum number. But the important thing is not that. The important thing is the control. We want to wait and see how the process itself is going to be controlled by external observers, European observers, and so on. Because this is key to that, because it's not simply 1 year there was a referendum and then within a few minutes the Minister of Interior coming out and announcing the thing and that's it, without even having the boxes haven't even been collected from. I want to say something else. The transition that we've been speaking about, that is in current or in the process or soon to start, there's a major element. That's culture. Svetlana spoke about culture. The law is there, the constitution is there, the media, everything. But who's going to prevent a policeman from kicking someone just because he doesn't like his head? This is in the culture. And it has to be important for the population. But it always comes afterwards. America had the greatest constitution, but until the 60s, civil rights movement. You know, what happened to the blacks in America until the 60s? But you look at the Constitution from 1776 and on, the Constitution is treats everyone is born and so on. And, you know, the Constitution rights of this, but not apply to blacks and not apply to this, not apply to that. The culture of democracy takes time. But we need first the laws. We have to have the founding laws and we have to have the founding principles so that people can express themselves without fear of being imprisoned and can discuss. We still, in our part of the world, we still have to learn to debate. We don't know how to debate. Any kind of meeting like this would be theses, one speaking here, one speaking here, one speaking here, one speaking there. We have to learn to negotiate. We have to learn to reach common ground. We have to learn. And this is going to take more time. You can watch Tunisian television today, these days, and compare it to that. There is everyone thinks that his or her views are the ones that should prevail. And we still have to learn the process of negotiation and the process of, because of these cultural problems. But we it is necessary first to have the texts, to have the laws, to have the constitution, to have the laws, the media laws, the freedom of expression laws, and all the institutions guaranteed before we can move on to the practice of true democracy, which takes time. Spain, 30 years now. It's been 30 years, Spain. And Romania, they're not yet there. Moldova, I don't know, almost, but still, there are problems.
Another similarity that I see between Morocco and Spain, but it was a very important factor, which I didn't mention in my resume of the transition, was the shadow of terrorism. And in Spain specifically, it was Basque terrorism. And the strategy of the Basque terrorists was to provoke the army to a coup. And that was what was greatly behind the attempted coup in 1982. That there was a feeling that the democracy was too weak on the terrorists. They were killing a civil guard a week practically. There was a tremendous toll and a tremendous resentment among the civil guards, and that was Tejero who walked into the parliament building, and with the sympathy of the military caste. There was a feeling that things were getting too loose. The democracy was not working for Spain. And that shadow continued all through the socialist government. The socialist government actually began fighting fire with the great scandals, because they started this group called the GAL that would go pop off terrorists or ETA suspects and so forth. And this was a great handicap for the continuance of Felipe González's power. And then let's not forget how the train bombs had a serious effect on the results of the election in 2004. And what is the terrorist factor? Was the bomb in Marrakesh perhaps aimed at derailing this process?
Every single observer noted that the explosion came at a moment which was designed to derail the process. Everybody saw the moment coming between now, which means that any bomb like that would reinforce certain powers that are against individual freedoms, etc. What happened? The contrast between 2003, we had our bombs in Casablanca in 2003, and now, in 2003, the people who did the thing blew themselves up. They were suicide bombers. But for everyone, they arrested all the friends, all the, you know, the acquaintances, etc., etc. But also arrested all the mentors. And then they went beyond that. They tried to uproot the ideology. Trying to uproot the ideology that made possible that. And of course, exaggeration. It was too much. 1,600 people were arrested. This time, not a single one. Until a week later, they announced 2 days ago that they arrested 3 people. And one of them had been involved in the Madrid bombings and returned to Morocco. And he's the one who tried something in Tangier. And finally, he was arrested with the help of, thanks to one of the Dutch people who were at the cafe. And he saw him very well. And he gave them the information, and they established his portrait, and they could get to him. But they did it in a peaceful manner respectful of human rights, and with help and methodology of the Europeans and the Americans. And but the timing is like the trains but this time for us it was designed to derail the democratic process, because an attack like that, an attack on a vital sector like tourism at the heart of Marrakesh, could only provoke a reaction that would push away freedom and so on. But even the group that calls itself the 20th of February, that started the process in Morocco, they decided to go tomorrow to Marrakesh and demonstrate against terrorism. So this is very important, because these people were angry young men and women are going to Marrakesh to demonstrate and say that terrorism is not going to derail us. We want this. And I think it's a positive aspect.
Yes, that's interesting too. Another similarity is how the grassroots, the people on the street, after the coup, there was a massive, one of the first massive demonstrations in Madrid in support of a democracy. And when a young councilman was kidnapped and then executed by ETA, there was also a tremendous outpouring of protest throughout Spain, but especially in Madrid, in which hundreds of thousands of people gathered. And finally, after the train bombing, it was extraordinary. I lived by the train station, and I was reporting on this. I was able to look out my balcony and give a on-the-spot report on how people were gathering. I had thought I might go to the street and see what the ambiance was, but it was quite clear there would be no way for me to make any progress because there was such a mass of people gathering a good kilometer away from where the center of the demonstration was going to take place. And there was over a million people. So the people valued their hard-won democracy, and they went out to protest. And that is what perhaps will be necessary at one point in the other two countries. Are there any questions? Yes.
So it's a question about Morocco. Earlier in the first panel, you mentioned that a major reason is that the educated people do not get a job in Morocco, and you have a high unemployment rate, which then led to the revolutions or uprising in the Arab world. Now, if you have a new constitution and democracy actually will start in Morocco, how will this continue with the unemployment problem? Will this be a danger to the new system?
Well, normally, I think in economic terms, in the end, democracy works better for the economies than dictatorship. Because dictatorships, and one of the slogans today in Morocco is, I say it in Arabic, it's the rental economy, or l'économie de rente, in which a lot of people are giving a lot of privileges just because they're part of the system. And if that were freed, just a stupid example like taxis, if they allowed people just any on the basis of giving authorization for people to have taxis, common people, then they will create a lot of jobs like that. Right now, you get taxis if you are somebody or if you know somebody, you can get 5 or 6 authorizations, which you simply, it's just a piece of paper. You rent it and you get money. The same thing with sand. They give people pieces of paper to get sand from the desert, or fishing, or just because they're generals or this or that. So the slogan is, first of all, democratization will help. Secondly, is the if they remove this, because it's a major slogan of the economy removing the barriers that distort economic processes. And thirdly, Morocco is lucky because we have a rich, diversified economy. Agriculture is a major investment for us. And fishing and minerals at the time of growing things, and also good growing emerging middle class. And I think that already Morocco is gaining points. I said this morning that economically, we are in the 5 to 6% growth rate each year, which is good. But with more democratization, I believe that this is going to go up because we have a lot of sectors in which we are competitive. And and also our agreement with Europe is helping a lot because we have two free trade agreements, one with Europe and with the United States. And it is helping upgrade the economic system with European help and also World Bank, and also because of all the projects that the king initiated. I did not have time to mention them, but a lot of projects, mega projects I call them, are coming to fruition, are supposed, Tangier, around Tangier, this whole new industrial city with a new harbor, new port, new roads, the freeways, and a lot of areas have been earmarked as priority areas. And these investments that I started speaking about are going to come to full, to start giving fruit by the time the democratization process has reached high speed. And that will create jobs, but not the kind of low-level jobs. The problem is, again, another problem is that us, the trainers, the universities, we have to also adapt so we can train the people that the economy of tomorrow is going to need.
short remark. Moldova, as well as Morocco, Tunisia, is part of European neighborhood policy and program initiated by EU, and this is also a mechanism that can enable changes in civil societies. What I thought about is for what reason people went to streets. They went to streets, at least in my region, because of the social economical reasons. What I would like to emphasize is the fact that international actors stress on civil and political rights, and leaving this social economical issue to the civil societies in our countries, it's quite a danger because this brings future rupture in the society. So, of course, this is to think about in which way international actors can contribute in order to create an open civil society, to contribute to the development of civil society, and obviously support it in many ways. Thank you.
Is there any comments or questions?
Hassan, with your very promising and interesting and good news from Morocco, my questions are, do you have any predictions for your next neighbor, for Algeria and for the other following country, for Libya, from your point of view?
Crystal ball. Libya is going to take, for me, it's going to take a while, because this is not a situation in which it looks like the rebels are going to be able to overcome Gaddafi, or that Gaddafi is going to, and then the Europeans and the Americans, especially the Europeans, especially France, they want to wait. They're helping one side, but not too much. They're helping one side, but they also want to, before they can stop, before they can give the decisive thing, they want to see how things develop. Who are the people they're going to hand the power to after 43 years of Gaddafi? So in Libya, it's all dark. Algeria, our neighbor, Algeria, they started the same month as Morocco, the same together with Tunisia, they started. But the army, which effectively rules in Morocco, it's the king, but in Algeria, it's the army, especially the one part of the army that is in charge of like the rest of the Arab world, in charge of maintaining the country in line. This part of the army, if you like, has decided not to allow people to demonstrate. So there have been no demonstrations, and as soon as a demonstration is called for, they deploy massively, and so far. But this is containing the bomb. And also, you know, the chess maker. There's a game of chess going on here, but they may be a chess maker. A chess maker cannot allow two things at the same time. Let's wait for Libya, and then we... Yemen, one oil country burning and one non-oil, not two oil countries burning at the same time. So it has to be first Libya to clarify before it can be Algeria. It has to be, that's why it was easier to do Tunisia and then Egypt, skip Libya and then Yemen and then now Syria. And when Syria is clear, they come back to Algeria. But in the meantime, Libya will be a model and so on. But there is a chess maker. I don't know who he is or who, what it is. Game of chess.
Yes. Are there any other questions? Yes.
Regarding the constitution drafting process in Morocco, I was wondering, you said that the king installed this process with all stakeholders giving their ideas and also deciding upon the, yeah, like each and every article in some way. And I was wondering in how far the king or the stakeholders ask for international legal assistance in this. Are they looking for best practice examples? I mean, it seems to be difficult to define democratization by citizens who have never really experienced that. And there may be the conflict that each and every interest group just tries to get their rights in and to exclude the others who might oppose their rights. And I just know that in Egypt, they asked for international help in this new process now, but I haven't really heard anything about Morocco. Can you give us any information?
Thank you for, I need to clarify one thing first, and then move on to your question. The clarification is that the process was simply informal. the voting on the articles. It was just an NGO. An NGO, one of the NGOs that created called Reform.ma. From Morocco itself. And of course, since it's the internet, it's open to all Moroccans abroad. So it's kind of anonymous. This is something separate. But the committee is presided by a constitutionalist, professor of constitutional law at our university, Professor Abdul Latif Menouni, a colleague of ours, and he is chairing this process. The process is to define the... Morocco has always been close to Europe, and Morocco, as the debate implicates the constitution of Spain and France and the United States and all. Morocco has always been close to Europe. Everything, half the people on this committee were educated in Europe. And the constitutions of Morocco were written by French constitutionalists. Only a couple of articles were engineered by our geniuses from... You understand? So, I think the most more important than the writing of the drafting of the constitution is the process of elections, voting. That has to be under the control of international observers, and that will be done. That will be done because nobody will trust the system if it simply declares itself. This is it, you know, we decide it's 99.99%. We have to have impartial observers who can certify that our decisions have been, at least the vote has been free of. Already, we have had two elections with, let's say, 20% more this, more clarity and more fairness than, it used to be 0%, and then jumps to 20 and 30, and the last elections were like 50%. 50% of the votes were correct. We're getting there. Well, look at it this way, not 0%. 50% is good. But now it's going to be more than that, surely, especially with the observers. But we work with your help. And they're all active, all of them. All the organizations, NGOs, the union, the delegation of the European Union, all of them are active in this process. But we have to see the first draft. That's the most important thing. And that's coming in the next few weeks. In June.
Next question.
So I find all three examples really fascinating. Now, Spain and Morocco are larger countries, but Moldova is really small. I don't know exactly, but I have in my head 3.5 million or something like that.
4.5 million?
Four and a half. Okay, sorry. So, but still. Do you think that's it is an advantage or a disadvantage to be small when you try to develop your own political and economic system?
Small countries, big countries, in between. I emphasized already this, that we continue to have a Russian influence, a strong Russian influence here, despite the army. We have supported from the bottom, supported NGOs and controversial issues discussed and historical arguments brought forward by politicians. As about population, 4.5, several hundreds of thousands are abroad earning their living and sending money back. And we have an older generation staying at home and voting. And I actually... quoted this earlier, this internet quotation that was going on during 2009 and 2010 elections. Younger people were writing, if you want to get over the communism, you should hide your grandma's passports. And students are talking in the classrooms about this. How can I persuade my relatives and my family to look left and right, to look ahead and think about our own future, not to think about the past and not to bring this nostalgic views about, oh, how nice was it, and we have bread costing 26 copeik. So this gap between generation is already there, and this is a good thing. I mean, we have a young people that want to move ahead. And what I was thinking about is the youth that actually brought those changes. And maybe they were less organized. That maybe some of them did not care about politics, what is happening on, but they took the lead. And and those, despite that they were baked by opposition. And so we have to think about how to keep alive this, how to continue working with youth in order to involve the youth in civil society projects, in NGOs. And what struck me was when I was checking an state alumni website, we have right now an Alumni Engagement Innovation Fund, and such projects like on Egypt or other African countries that are based on working with on civil society issue, on changing civil society, got most voters. Yeah, so those events should be turned into learned lessons, and also the youth, the enthusiasm and the optimism they see towards the future should be taken into an activity, into actions, and of course it could be could lead to policy recommendations to political actors, and to why not to foreign supporting organizations as well. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments?
One question regarding the comparison between Morocco and Spain. In Spain, the king had, as well as in Morocco, political power, but not the economic power. In Morocco, the king, his family, his friends have enormous economic power. They hold lots of companies, supermarket chains. Now, with the democratic changes and with the economic changes you have hinted, they will lose this economic power. People don't like to lose business. They don't like to lose money. They might oppose these reforms. Can you comment on this?
Yes, I think that the if you look carefully at what happened, I think the king has been preparing himself for this for past 10 years, which means that the organization that used to own the fortunes of the king had been gradually diluted inside the general economy. A lot of companies were sold, others were bought, and in the end, a holding company was created, which is an investment company in which the fortune of the king and his family is a fraction, only a few points. And the king himself, a couple of years ago, and then again last month, announced the creation of an organization for economic competition, so that to attack this problem directly in front. And of course, the people are asking that if you are in power, this is part of the debate going on, if you are in power, you cannot be both the arbiter and also a member of the economic thing. So this is clear, and it's going to be integrated in what's coming. I think the people are aware of this. Even if, as I said, the king has transformed the structure of his companies to something much wider and includes the economy in general, an investment, the National Investment Society, which groups. It's open because anyone can buy in it, but in which the properties of the king and so on, the companies that the king owns are only represent a fraction, 5%, 6%, I don't know how much. So that it's not a massive thing anymore. But the real economy in Morocco is coming from public-private companies and also international, the opening, the globalization, the big companies that are coming in and starting. For example, for tourism, Morocco did the infrastructure. And now, investment in tourism is coming to all these places that were prepared by the Moroccan taxpayers. And they're international companies. They benefit from the conditions. And Morocco is advertising now in the international media about bring your money. We can help. Competing with Turkey, with Kazakhstan, God knows how many other countries are doing this. But a lot of people from Europe think Morocco, because of its closeness to Europe, has advantages. Especially in whenever a new industrial city is created by the government, it's quickly so oversubscribed. There's one near Tangier, as I said. Already 100 companies related to the automotive industry are going to settle there because of Renault. Renault-Nissan is building a car there, and it's a good thing. But we have to do some work before. But that question of the personal properties is going to be, it's clear in the minds of the people, and they demand a change to that, and it's going to be affected, and not in a violent way, but because it has been prepared over the last few years.
Well, I'm getting signals from our handlers here that our time is up, and I think that is a good question to have ended this panel. We thank you very much for your attention.